né? Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Those are the opening words of the passage that was read from the Gospel of Matthew. It's only one sentence, but there are at least three components to that sentence that already give me pause, even before reading the rest of the passage, of what comes after. And that first sentence is where I'd like to focus most of my meditation this morning, those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dozen words or so. The rest of the passage, I suspect, is probably pretty familiar to most of us. Jesus is being tempted in the wilderness. He demonstrates his wisdom or his strength in rejecting the wiles of the tempter. We've probably all heard numerous sermons over the years that then try to explain the various ways that Jesus is tempted and attempt to somehow link his response to how we should respond to the kinds of temptations that sometimes beset us. That's not what I'm going to do this morning. Depending on how you understand what's going on in that passage, he's either being pushed to prove that he's the Son of God, or he's engaged in some sort of cosmic struggle with the devil. He's in effect being offered an easy way out when it comes to, quote-unquote, gaining the whole world by worshiping the tempter. But as I said, I think I'm going to limit myself to the first sentence and grapple with what in there already raises some issues for me or some questions. And Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. The first thing I'd like to note, even before attacking that sentence, is to note that this event is placed right after Jesus' baptism by John the Baptist. It's therefore right at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, and I think that of itself is somewhat significant. We have here a man who I think is very conscious of his calling. He's about to embark on a ministry that ultimately turns out to be one that lasts 3 years. But at this point, I think it might be safe to assume that he feels the need to take a deep breath and draw on whatever internal resources he has that he might need to face the challenges that are coming with this massive ministry. And so according to all of the synoptic gospels, he's led into the wilderness. The Gospel of John doesn't mention this episode at all, so it's limited to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The whole passage is fraught with symbolism, I think. This whole description of what's going on in the wilderness. And the symbolism appears in a couple of ways. The underlining of the amount of time spent in the wilderness is, I think, a fairly obvious parallel to some other episodes in the history of Israel. Moses spends 40 days fasting on Mount Sinai. He spends 40 years in exile before coming back to Egypt to liberate the Hebrews. The people of Israel wander in the desert for 40 years. Elijah travels for 40 days to get to Mount Horeb. So the whole 40 days, 40 years thing there's some significance there in the communal thought of the day. So I think it's clear that there's symbolism and there's metaphor at work in this passage. But I think there's also a dose of a very human need to sometimes step away from the day-to-day imperatives of life in order to carve out some space for reflection, to be able to gain some perspective on what one feels called to do. A time apart during which one can focus without the distractions of the world and the people around us, and a recognition that Jesus, the man, is aware that he's about to see his world turn upside down, and that this wilderness experience is a necessary preliminary to his ministry. And again, this wilderness concept, or this wilderness as an idea, is a concept in Scripture that's sometimes portrayed as a dry, barren, lifeless zone where your vulnerabilities are exposed. And I suppose there's, you know, possibly some truth to that. I've never spent time in a wilderness environment that would fit that description. My wilderness experiences have been Canadian wilderness experiences, which tend to be, to some degree, actually the opposite of dry, barren, and lifeless. My own experience of wilderness has been an immersion in a lush, green, vibrant environment that, rather than generating a sense of abandonment, has invigorated me. It's energized me. It's provided me with a sense of being grounded in ways that are sometimes difficult in urban life. But part of that reality, of being in that kind of an environment of wilderness, is that when we're on a family canoe trip in Algonquin or in La Vérendrye, we are in the wilderness, and our focus is very much centered on the essentials of life. We're not particularly concerned about with whatever the politicians of the day are up to, or what new scandal has gripped Hollywood, or whether the potholes on our street will be fixed anytime soon. We're living much more in the moment and interested in things like, how can we keep our canoes stable when we're going from site to site? Where can we find a decent site to set up our camp? How is the weather changing, and what do we need to do to prepare for that change? What do we need to do to avoid attracting animals? And because of Mary Lou's sensibilities in particular, how can we avoid attracting bears to our site? What will we eat and how will we cook it? And although those concerns may seem somewhat stress-laden, for me, our annual canoe trip in the wilderness for a week at a time hasn't been a time of stressful survival. It's survival, yeah. But it's a time for leaving behind the cares of the world and recalibrating my own sense of what's essential and figuring out how we can all pitch in and make the experience both safe and memorable. Sort of a microcosm of life. How can we all pitch in and make the experience safe and memorable for all? My solo hikes in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, on the other hand, have been a little bit more along the lines, perhaps, of what Jesus might have experienced in this passage in Matthew's Gospel, at least in the sense that they've been solo excursions, and they've sometimes been triggered by something of an existential crisis on my part, a sense that I needed to get away to take stock when I was starting to feel overwhelmed by various things in life. And this first sentence of the Matthew passage makes me wonder if Jesus isn't in one of those pivotal moments. He's being led by the Spirit into the wilderness. I take that to mean that he needs to get away. The Spirit is pulling him away from the day-to-day stuff into this wilderness experience. This isn't just a spontaneous decision one morning to get up and go for a walk in the desert for a month. It's a move prompted by the Holy Spirit as part of preparing the groundwork for Jesus' ministry. And according to the Gospel writers, he's being led into the wilderness so that he can be tempted by the devil. And that's the second thing about that sentence that I find myself reacting to. I've never really cared for this idea that Jesus is being led into the desert for the deliberate purpose of being tempted by the devil. So this idea of temptation stands out in this first sentence of the Matthew passage for me. And the word tempted, though, in most versions of the New Testament, is a translation of the Greek word peirazo, which apparently could more faithfully be translated as to be tested rather than to be tempted. In other words, it makes me wonder if Jesus, or even the writers of the Gospels, are suggesting that Jesus isn't there in the wilderness to overcome temptation so much as to take time out to test his calling. In other places in the Old Testament, Gideon puts out a fleece to sort of ask God, if it does this, I'll do that. If it does that, I'll do this. A chance to get into the wilderness to grapple with the implications of what he feels called to do. Two, as I said earlier, to take a deep breath and prepare for what's to come, to test whether he's ready for this ministry. And it's speculation, and the content of the passage certainly gives the impression that temptation is the more accurate description of what's going on, certainly the way it's described. But even there, I think the very nature of the symbolism and metaphor of that passage requires us to step back from it a little bit, step back from a literal reading of what's going on. For example, we're told in the passage that the devil takes Jesus to the top of a very high mountain so that he can see all the kingdoms of the world. Well, if we take that literally, there is no mountain on earth where one can see all the kingdoms of the world. So there's imagery at play here, and very poetic imagery. And I think we need to step back from a literal reading to try to get a sense of what Jesus is struggling with on a human level during those 40 days. I think one possible scenario is that he's weighing the pros and cons of continuing on the path of life as a carpenter or embarking on a path that will end with his death on a cross. And I don't think that to suggest that is to diminish Jesus' divinity in any way or to question whether or not Jesus was the Messiah. I frankly think that this episode in the wilderness is a foretaste of what Jesus will experience in the Garden of Gethsemane on the eve of his crucifixion. And I wonder if this passage might not, in effect, be paired with Gethsemane as two bookends to his ministry, in that he knows where this calling will lead, and he's struggling at the beginning of his ministry to find the strength to say, not my will, but yours be done, just as he does in the final hours of his ministry. That those two things are a parenthesis for his entire life as a roaming prophet. And that struggle, I think, is in the very broadest sense what this passage has to say to us as disciples of Jesus 2,000 years later. It's not, I don't think, primarily a glimpse into the wisdom of Jesus and the wiles of Satan. I think it's perhaps a hint at the depth of conviction and commitment we need to cultivate if we're to embark on this path that Jesus has prepared for us. In other words, it's a hint that being a follower of Jesus is not something you decide to do casually one morning. You don't get up and go for a walk for a lifetime on the spur of the moment. It's something you accept after weighing the cost. And Jesus certainly offers that very caution in a number of his parables. Weigh the cost of what following me will mean for you. Be prepared to do whatever it takes. Be prepared to leave behind whatever you need to leave behind. Be prepared to be shunned and mocked and persecuted because you believe that there's a way to live together in a society that allows for justice tempered with mercy and humility, and where the most vulnerable among you will be protected and cared for. Be prepared to work towards having the capacity to echo Jesus' own words, not my will, but yours be done. And finally, the third element of that first sentence in Matthew that gives me pause. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. To be tempted by the devil. The devil. A literal, personal, evil demigod out to undermine Jesus' ministry and God's plan for humanity. This is another reason that I think I, at least, prefer to read this passage as poetic imagery of what Jesus is going through in the wilderness rather than as a historical description of what actually happened. For one thing, the only person who would have been witness to this is Jesus. So either Jesus said, you know, this is what happened to me, or Matthew and Luke have embellished on the fact that he was in the wilderness. But it strikes me that this is a very similar scenario to what we read in the first parts of Genesis, where we have these pure humans in the garden, in the wilderness, with a mandate from God to behave a certain way. And then the tempter comes to undermine the work of God by drawing them to be disobedient. In the Garden of Genesis, the tempter wins out, and death for humanity is the result. And yet here in the wilderness in the Gospels, the tempter tries the same thing, but the tempter loses out, and life for humanity is the result. So it strikes me that, again, there's a bit of a bookmarking or bookending kind of thing going on here. One of the passages that was suggested for this morning from the Leader magazine program for Lent is a passage from Romans 5, verses 12 to 19. I'll read a couple of excerpts from that passage. Paul writes, "Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death came through sin, and so death spread to all because all have sinned, if because of one man's trespass death exercised dominion through that one, much more surely will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness exercise dominion in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. Therefore, just as one man's trespass led to condemnation for all, so one man's righteousness leads to justification and life for all." Again, it seems to me that we have a somewhat deliberate pairing of bookends here. Death because of one man's sin, life because of one man's capacity to say, "Not my will, but yours be done." But delving into the implications of all of that is a meditation for another day. Thank you.